Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Sarah Seeger will discuss the search for exoplanets and habitable worlds.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here. Well, exoplanets, as you may know, is a field of science that involves many different areas of physics, from the Doppler shift and gravitational microlensing for detection of exoplanets, to fluid dynamics to describe atmospheric circulation, to quantum mechanics, which we use to make new molecular line lists for rotational vibrational lines, even involving some biophysics. But exoplanets were not a branch of astrophysics that will ever discover new physics, like dark energy or dark matter, or inform the standard model of physics in any way. But the one thing we have, and the reason why the whole world is awakening to this huge and growing excitement, is the search for another Earth, and our first chance ever in human history to try to find signs of life on these other worlds. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about. Here's what I'm going to go over. And before I get started, I just want you to know that I started out working in theoretical cosmology in a narrow subfield on recombination in the early universe. How exactly did the universe become neutral in the last scattering surface? And I actually may have stayed in theoretical cosmology. Perhaps I would have been here giving one of the other talks. But when I'd finished that project, I was in graduate school and looking for a PhD topic. And at that time, the first reports of exoplanets orbiting sun-like stars came in. And my advisor at the time said, well, why don't you work on these new exoplanets? So I said, yes. And here, about 20 years later, I am to tell you about all the exciting things I'm going on right now. Now, in exoplanets, even though in our own galaxy, there are hundreds of billions of stars, and our universe has upwards of hundreds of billions of galaxies. And if we think that every star has planets, that's just so many planets. But actually, in our search for habitable worlds, in our search for signs of life, we're constrained to our local solar neighborhood, as shown by this little tiny circle on this graph right here. Now, I'm going to start out just with some material that you can really enjoy, starting with this software. It's called Eyes on Exoplanets, and you can all download it and show it to your friends and family. Here, it shows you what our Milky Way galaxy looks like from above, zooming in towards our sun, where all of the highlighted stars are stars with known exoplanets. Here, the software is zooming in to our planet Earth. You can actually, if you look closely, see some heliocentric orbiting spacecraft, Epoxy, Spitzer, and others. And this software, you can go to any part of Earth. Here, we'll go to the west coast of North America, and looking out on a spring night, here's what you would see. Well, not the constellations overlaid, but you could look around and see all the highlighted stars with known planets, and there's one very special patch of the sky. It's where the Kepler Space Telescope looked for 4 years, every 6 seconds taking data, and every few months downlinking data to Earth. In this software, you can search for planets if you know some of their names, and one of our favorites is Kepler-186. This is a star, it's an M-dwarf star, about half the mass of the Sun. And this particular system has 5 planets. Actually, we know of many of these so-called compact multiple planet systems. In this particular case, one of the planets lies in the habitable zone, the zone around the star where, heated by the star, considering the planet to have a thin atmosphere, it would be not too hot and not too cold, but just right to life. Here, we're further zooming in, and this is where the fine print says, hypothetical visualization of planet. Okay, but still, you can go to this software, and it's really quite remarkable. I've seen people of all ages fool around with this, click on stars, and actually, I've even seen children play with this software and get an intuitive sense of, yeah, you know what? There are lots of planets in habitable zones of stars. So I urge you to all go in and take a look at the software. Now, as scientists, of course, we prefer to look at graphs. So I have a graph to show you, one of my favorites in all of exoplanets. And starting with the plot on the left, I want you to appreciate that this is a logarithmic plot. It's over many, many, many orders of magnitude. You can see planet mass and orbital period in days, planets with periods shorter than 1 day out to thousands of days or more. And here's Earth, shown here, Neptune and Jupiter. And what you can see from this plot is that there are many different successful exoplanet finding techniques. I'm not going to describe the techniques today. I just want you to know there's a lot of them out there and a lot of successful techniques. There's also selection effects for each technique. Each technique has a different part of the diagram. And it's actually fair to say that the dark part of the diagram, is dark because techniques can't find planets there yet. Now here on the right side, you can see planet size versus orbital period. And on this planet is all the planet harvest from the Kepler Space Telescope. So I want you to look at the points for a moment in yellow. Those are the Kepler planets. And the planets from the left plot that only have a mass measurement are converted to size by approximate planet mass radius models. So what's so amazing about this Kepler data here is, first it shows you a selection effect. Planets at Earth's position actually were not found by Kepler. And you can ask me more about that in the question period. But what you can see, even by eye here, is the density of planets, where Kepler found the type of planet that Kepler has found to be the most common. And I'm not going to get into completeness and what, I'm not showing you like an actual scientific graph with error bars, but you can see where it looks all overlapped in black, that actually the most common type of planet, according to Kepler, are planets about 2 to 3 times the size of Earth. This is a type of planet with no solar system counterpart. And here is one of our biggest mysteries in exoplanets. We thought before, when we only had our solar system to study, that Jupiter would be the end goal of the end product of planet formation, where Jupiter is born as rocks and dust accumulate and ices until the planet became about 10 Earth masses. We thought that planets, and we didn't mean me necessarily, but everyone thought that planets would just accumulate all the material around them in their feeding zone and hit the sort of end size and mass only when all the material around it and its gravitational influence was exhausted. But lo and behold, there are all these kind of stunted planets, smaller than Neptune, and in fact, planets smaller still, the size of Earth may be even more common, we just don't know. Okay, so there's a lot of planets out there, and at this point I'll just say it's hard to imagine that when I started out in exoplanets, in fact a few years later when I was on the job market, that some of our very esteemed institutions in North America wouldn't want to hire anyone working in exoplanets, because they said at the time that we will never have more than one transiting planet. And Kepler here has found thousands and thousands of transiting planets. So it's a field that has really taken off. And to illustrate some of these planets, before I get into some more details of models and physics, let me just take you on a tour of some of our favorite exoplanets. So the one we saw in the animation, Kepler-186f. This is a series of travel posters made by NASA for you to enjoy. It says Kepler-186f, where the grass is always redder on the other side, because it's an M star, and people are thinking if the M star has the peak of its output energy at red wavelengths, maybe if photosynthesis or some energy harvesting mechanism develops on this planet, it will have pigments in the red. HD40307G. It says, enjoy, experience the gravity of HD40307G, a super Earth. Many planets we know are more massive than Earth, and they will have a higher gravity, maybe by a factor of 1.5 or 2. Relax on Kepler-16b, the land of two suns, where your shadow always has company. And we now know of circumbinary planets, planets that orbit two suns. We know about a dozen of them, but there are probably many more out there in the data. So science fiction got some things right. one of my favorite planets is Kepler-10b. This is a super Earth. It's a rocky planet, a few times the mass of Earth. And actually, you know what? This planet has an orbital period of less than one day, 0.85 days. And it's so close to its sun-like star, you know, by Kepler's law, it's very, very close to the star. It's 20 times closer to its star than Mercury is to our sun. We know planets didn't form that close to the star because there's just not enough material. So planet migration, how planets interact with the gas and the other planetesimals in the disk and migrate through, and how they stop and not fall into their star is another big open question in planetary physics. And this planet is so hot because it's so close to the star that we imagine the planet is hot enough so that the surface is hot enough to melt rock. And so the liquid lava would be there, not because of any tidal interactions or volcanoes, but just because the surface is heated so much. Now, most of our planets, here's Gliese 1214b, we don't even really have enough information to speculate on what might be going on that planet. And here you see with the artist's conception, the artist, I think, always has to show some nebulosity because planets sometimes are not necessarily that interesting. But here, for this particular planet, we have a mass and a size, and it's what we like to call these ones a mini Neptune. It's one of those 2.5 times the size of Earth, one of those most common types of planets out there. And this one's somewhat close to the star. Its temperature and its atmosphere may be about 700 Kelvin. Now, I chose this one to tell you about what we work on exoplanets. So this is a kind of an unfortunate case because this particular planet has a mass and size and average density such that we don't actually know what the planet's made of. It could be, if you look on the far right, a rocky planet with a massive rocky core surrounded by hydrogen atmosphere. All planets, even Earth, was born with hydrogen in its atmosphere from outgassing of the planet-forming material. And so alternatively, this could be a new type of planet we speculate about, a water world, shown on the far left. And a water planet, you could imagine, is like a scaled-up version of one of Jupiter's icy moons, 50% water or more by mass. And in this particular case, the planet being about 700 Kelvin in its atmosphere, it could have a thick steam atmosphere overlaying an ocean, not of liquid water, but the temperatures and pressures are such that it could have a layer of superfluid water. Here on Earth, the only place where superfluid water is naturally occurring is at the deep sea vents under the oceans. And in this particular case, there'd also be high-pressure hot ices on the inside, like ice 7 or something like that. So actually, some areas of exoplanets, despite having precision measurements in the mass and the size, we get to a dead end. We really can't say anything else. We could quantify all the possibilities of what the planet is made of, assuming that it's spherically symmetric and differentiated, meaning the denser materials on the inside. And often we just have to leave it at that. So it was a little disappointing to, you know, to go through these last couple decades and then know that a lot of areas we just dead end and then we move on to something else. So now I'm going to tell you about exoplanet mass and size and what we do with them. And I'm showing you another big picture graph here where the axes also cover many orders of magnitude. So here you can see planet size and planet mass, and these are in Earth units. And you can see here, Earth and Venus are together at about one Earth mass, one Earth size. Uranus and Neptune are up here. And we also have Saturn and Jupiter. And I hope this can convey to you just how many planets we have with a measured mass and size, although you can see the smaller and smaller planets have quite big uncertainties in their measurements. Now, the solid curves are curves of constant composition for illustration. And so let's take, for example, this solid red curve, which would be like a pure silicate planet. We don't think anything like that exists, but just for illustration purposes, if you take that planet that's pure silicate and add mass to it, it gets bigger. But actually, it doesn't get bigger by R cubed. The planet will get bigger by something slightly smaller, because as you add mass to the outer layers, the inner material compresses. And actually, what's so interesting is that you can see how all the curves of constant composition turn over, that if you get to a high enough planet mass, what happens is electron degeneracy pressure in the inside. So as you add mass to the outer layers, actually in the inside, the material on the inside gets pressure ionized. And so the nuclei, without their electron, some of their electrons bound, can get squeezed closer together. And actually, it's kind of cool. If you look at Jupiter here, for other planets that are Jupiter size, you can see that they span one or two orders of magnitude in mass for the same planet size, showing this thing of electron degeneracy pressure in some planet interiors. Now, for Jupiter also, for the same mass, there are planets of up to about 1.75 times the size of Jupiter. And this is another thing we don't fully understand, why planets, even if they're hot, are so puffed out, actually. So we sometimes put a problem on the back burner and then come back to it later when there are some less exciting things going on. So those are the giant planets here. And down here, there's rocky planets. I know a lot of them look like they have very big error bars, but we have some with precision measurements, which in this case would be about like 2% is the best we could ever do. And that mostly comes from uncertainties in the size of the star and the mass of the star. And for a growing number of stars, mostly thanks to the Kepler Space Telescope, we're able to get astroseismology measurements and pin the mass and size down from a typical 5% uncertainty to about 1% or 2%. And that feeds down into actually the planet parameters. So actually, the proof that rocky planets exist are these planets down here, that no matter what ingredients you imagine the planet to be made of, its density, that's mass and size and density, is just such that it basically has to be predominantly rocky. So we have evidence that there are rocky planets out there, and that's sort of where we're at for being excited about our future in the search for habitable worlds. Now, to make these models, I put some simple equations that I hoped you would all recognize. We do to study planet interiors. We would use the mass of a spherical shell and hydrostatic equilibrium in each shell. Those are the first two equations. And then the equation of state, actually, it's where all the hard work is. That's where all of the physics is right now, actually. And this equation of state, we do have to borrow heavily from high-pressure geophysics, where I have a little cartoon where at the bottom here, lab experiments get us to about a few hundred gigapascals. And this is, high-pressure geophysics with diamond anvil cells that squeeze material closer and closer together, and they're sometimes laser-heated to get the appropriate temperature. Now, the very high pressures, we can use where electron degeneracy pressure becomes increasingly important, we actually use a theoretical equation of state, the Thomas Fermi-Dirac equation of state, an approximate way to characterize the interactions of electrons and nuclei. Like, not all planets are getting that massive in the interior, and that TFD theory, it actually does not describe chemical bonds, and it's insensitive to the arrangement of atoms. And so for the massive planets, there's a bit of a problem, because these interior pressure range, we don't have a way to reach it by experiment, really, or by some asymptotic theory. So in that case, we turn to our friends and colleagues who work on density functional theory, and I used to always ask them to make me a new equation of state, and they'd come back and say it'll take 3 months on a supercomputer. And so sometimes we just live without that and just kind of go forward, because in interiors of planets, atoms are packed so closely together, there's not a huge variation in the pressures that in the parameters we really care about when we model the interiors of planets. So to summarize that first part of my talk, exoplanets are diverse. They cover nearly all masses, sizes, and orbits possible. The planets we haven't found yet in the dark part of the mass period and the radius period diagram are where actually we haven't been able to look yet. And so in terms of exoplanets and planetary systems, I always like to say that anything is possible within the laws of physics and chemistry. Now, the point I want you to walk away with, in case you hadn't heard it before, one new thing I want you to remember is that small planets, about twice Earth's size, are nearly 10 times as common as Jupiter-sized planets. And this is a big challenge for planet formation theory. For many planets, despite having measured masses and radii, a permanent ambiguity will remain. So now I'm going to turn to habitable planets. And these are planets where we have a so-called habitable zone, or Goldilocks zone. It's been called for decades. And this particular habitable zone, it's shown here in this cartoon in green, where it's not too hot, not too cold, but just right for surface liquid water. The temperatures are just right, and that's assuming a thin atmosphere, and the planet is heated by the star. We see here in this illustration, planets are, some would be too hot, some would be too cold. And I wanted to just give you an update on the scenario of what people are thinking now. And because exoplanets are so diverse, we honestly almost have to just throw out that concept of the habitable zone and think about it planet by planet. And the reason is actually the same reason that some people are so worried about Earth's atmosphere. Imagine for a moment that here on Earth, we're worried about adding parts per million of carbon dioxide. And that would change our surface temperature in the future and change our planet. Actually, imagine now a planet that has way more carbon dioxide. Maybe it has 100 times more, 1,000, or even more, actually. That planet would be much hotter on the surface. And so just that whole concept of what's in the planet atmosphere really drives the whole habitable zone. And here I'm showing you a habitable zone graph. And it starts out with the mass of the star relative to the sun. So here is our sun at 1 solar masses. And down here, it's a small M dwarf star. Up here is a bigger star. Radius of orbit relative to Earth's orbit. You can see Earth here. And the other solar system planets, Jupiter, Saturn. And these curves illustrations are drawn just with real model boundaries. So in the blue, it's showing you an Earth-like planet atmosphere, where we consider that at the one end, our habitables, if our Earth was too close to the sun, the oceans would literally boil off, and our atmosphere would have a runaway, we'd have a runaway greenhouse problem, where our atmosphere would fill with water vapor, and the water vapor would get photodissociated by UV radiation with the hydrogen escaping to space. On the other side, it's if Earth got moved further and further away, actually the carbon dioxide would freeze out. And without without water and carbon dioxide, our biggest greenhouse gases, Earth would freeze. So the new part I'll tell you about has to do with extending the habitable zone outwards, far outwards, as shown by this blue part of the atmosphere. Well, remember I mentioned hydrogen? We actually imagine, we don't have evidence yet, that planets, big rocky planets, that are massive or cold enough actually will maintain hydrogen. You know, on our planet, we don't have hydrogen or helium in our atmosphere. The analogy is like when you hold that helium balloon and let go and it just escapes to space. Well, hydrogen actually, if a planet could maintain it, and actually it's a good thing our Earth doesn't have it because it's a very potent greenhouse gas. Hydrogen itself, it's a homonuclear molecule, so it doesn't absorb in the same way that carbon dioxide and other molecules absorb. They have like discrete absorption bands. But hydrogen at high enough pressures, it gets collision-induced absorption properties. And so actually, hydrogen can absorb continuously across a broad range of near-infrared and infrared wavelengths. And actually, hydrogen is a very potent greenhouse gas. It actually doesn't even condense until tens of Kelvin at about 1 to 100 bar pressures. So you have to imagine that a planet with hydrogen will maintain some kind of greenhouse, and it could actually be habitable at further and further distances from the star, perhaps as far out as Jupiter, Even some people have postulated maybe free-floating planets that were expelled from their planetary system during the chaotic time of the early planetary system may actually even be habitable floating through space. So Earth and Venus are about the same size and mass, but Earth has life and a great surface to live on, and Venus is completely inhospitable to life. So we need spectra to get more information. And that leads to the next part of my talk, where in addition to mass and size and energy hitting the planet from the star, we actually have atmosphere measurements. And so actually, in science fiction got some things really wrong, because science fiction said we had to travel there sometimes to get it right. In Star Trek, the Enterprise would have to travel great distances at incredible speeds to get in orbit around another planet so that Spock could actually analyze if the atmosphere was habitable and if there were life forms on the planet. So I always wondered if in science fiction, it was just too boring to imagine observing remotely, us building like a giant telescope and trying to put it somewhere on the ground and develop adaptive optics, or going beyond low Earth orbit to have a great sky away from the Earth. But actually, I don't know, that would have been a little boring, but actually it's quite exciting. We have our Hubble Space Telescope, and this is a real picture taken by the Atlantis Space Shuttle as it departed from its last servicing mission. And on that servicing mission, a great thing happened for exoplanets, actually. It was the installation of the Wide Field Camera 3, which for some reason that I don't know, it had a great detector, very stable. Because you know Hubble, it's orbiting Earth every 90 minutes. Heats up, cools down, heats up, cools down. And it orbits every 90 minutes, but transits last on the order of hours. And so it's really bad to chop up your transit with something that's heating up and cooling down and expanding slightly in different parts of the telescope. So this detector was very stable, and it made a huge new generation of exoplanet atmospheres possible. And so to study planet atmospheres, the main way we study them now is with transiting planets. And I'm showing you this cartoon diagram here with a planet, not to scale at all, it's way too big. But do you see the little blue annulus? That's the atmosphere of the planet. And I want you to think for a moment, because this is the whole, in a nutshell, the way we observe and interpret exoplanet atmospheres, is that at some wavelengths, is that the light from the background star shines through the optically thin part of the atmosphere. And by taking a spectrum, when the planet is not in front of the star, and then when it is in front of the star, and differencing those two, we're actually left with the imprint of the stellar light on the planet atmosphere. And the part that I want you to think about for a moment is that at wavelengths where the planet is opaque, at wavelengths where there's a lot of absorption going on, the planet actually looks slightly bigger. And if it had no atmosphere at all, the planet would look, or a part of the atmosphere that's completely transparent to radiation, then the planet would look smaller. And so that's why on this plot, it's showing you absorption in percent here. So you can see if the planet had no atmosphere at these wavelengths are between 1.1 and 1.7 microns, it's a pretty narrow area, but there's this water vapor feature at 1.4 micron. And so if the planet didn't have any absorption, then you would just see a straight line. So hopefully all of you can see here and agree with me that it's not a straight line here. Well, this one looks the best. And here you can also then look at how many decimal places you have to go to make this measurement, and it's not as high precision as what some of you have talked about, but considering the telescope is really somewhat unstable, actually it's a big triumph for exoplanet atmospheres that we've detected water vapor in a few hot Jupiters. Now the hot Jupiters are big and hot, and we expect them to have water vapor naturally occurring just because they have hydrogen and oxygen and all the other common elements. So now I'm going to return to Gliese 1214b, the planet I told you about, where we weren't sure what it's made of, because it could be this new thing called, we call it the water world with the thick steam atmosphere, or maybe it's a giant rocky planet with a big hydrogen atmosphere. And so what we initially thought was that we may have these three cartoons here, that if the planet actually had a hydrogen atmosphere, it's very puffy. The scale height of hydrogen, where the scale height here refers to the E folding factor of the pressure or density change with height, the pressure and density drop off with altitude. The analogy I like to give there, it's like with Mount Everest. You know how climbers climb Everest and they run out of air? Well, if we here on Earth lived on a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, they wouldn't run out of air at all, because the scale height, that E folding factor, where you on Earth it's about 8 kilometers, but on these on a hydrogen-rich planet, it's actually like a factor of 20 better. So the puffy atmospheres are good for exoplanet transits, because we expect to have a lot of atmosphere for that light to go through when it's coming from the star going through the atmosphere. There's a lot of atmosphere to sample. Now, on the other hand, if the planet was a water world with a thick steam atmosphere, Atmosphere has a much higher molecular weight, and that whole atmosphere, the dense part of the atmosphere where the spectral lines can form, is quite close, squished close to the planet. And so in that case, we'd only expect to see a little line here. So the red on this curve here is transit depth in percent. You don't have to worry too much about that scale here. This is wavelength in microns, visible wavelengths here, out to infrared wavelengths. These data points are with the Hubble Space Telescope. These are with ground-based telescopes. So the blue line here is the compressed water vapor atmosphere, the thick steam atmosphere. The red would be for the hydrogen-rich atmosphere. Okay, big, huge lines because it's a puffy atmosphere. And then we have this unfortunate situation we might have where clouds would block any rays at all and we wouldn't see anything. So when you look at this here, just from far away, what do you think? Do you think that looks cool? Good? Do you think you might see water vapor? You know, in exoplanets, time and again, I've been involved with things where we have like this 2.9 sigma event. And a lot of people stress about it. I no longer stress about it because most of the time it actually turns out to be nothing, actually. But it usually is enough time to get more telescope time. It's usually enough to get more telescope time. And in this case, at the time, one of my students worked on it and said, you know, instead of like looking for a few hours of data for one transit, we need 10 transits. And he actually was able to get an unprecedented amount of time on Hubble for an exoplanet to get more data. But just before I go on, I was just trying to say here that the depth of the lines, it's related to that annulus of the atmosphere, the area of the annulus superimposed on the whole area of the star. So you have area of the annulus, area of the star, and I just threw in an extra factor of few because the atmosphere may be a few scale heights high before the density drops off so much that you can't get any lines to form. And here's the pressure scale height, just so you saw what the parameters were. So what happened with this planet, current mystery, here's the better data with the wide field camera 3. And what you're seeing here now is, again, you can ignore this axis for now, but here we have wavelengths and microns. And this is the part that we looked at before that I asked you whether you thought there was water vapor. And here is it zoomed in. So this is the planet size, and here's the wavelength. It's that 1.4 micron feature, which I showed you in some other data was in other planets. But in Gliese 1214, we don't see anything. There's just a straight line here of data. And this is an example of an exoplanet where we may just have a permanent mystery, because although we have a mass and a size and lots of data in terms of telescope time on Hubble for observing the atmosphere, we just got nothing, actually. And so this is the type of thing people are puzzling over now. Is this planet just cloudy? You know, and it's the case like where when you fly through Earth's atmosphere, if you get above a cloud deck, you can't see anything below. That kind of dense part of the atmosphere where the spectral lines were formed is just hidden from view. We're kind of thinking that might be what's going on, and that even with the planet at 700 Kelvin, there are still particles that could condense and make solids. So we're not sure. We'll have to wait and see what happens, or this particular planet may be a dead end. Okay, so I've established now, hopefully you all agree, we know of thousands of planets. We have examples that rocky planets exist. We have atmosphere measurements for exoplanets. And so what I really wanted to talk to you about now was about the search for signs of life on other planets. And by searching for signs of life, I specifically mean gases in an atmosphere that may be produced by life. And the question is, given that exoplanets are so diverse, we've seen that planets exist in nearly every mass and size and orbit imaginable that we can detect so far, what would we look for in another planet? What kind of gases would we look for? Well, actually, it turns out that this was so astonishing to me when I thought about this, prompted by a friend, that in our own atmosphere, on Earth's atmosphere, every gas, nearly every single gas to the part per trillion level, with the exception of the noble gases, is produced by life. Actually, although most of those gases have a different dominant source, nitrogen's already in our atmosphere, carbon dioxide is already in the atmosphere, but these gases actually are all produced by life. I just think this is so amazing. Now, on Earth, oxygen is our most robust biosignature gas. Okay, our own planet, we breathe oxygen. Oxygen's a highly reactive gas. Without life, though, without plants and photosynthetic bacteria, actually, we shouldn't have any oxygen. It would be less than its current 20%. It would be about 10 orders of magnitude less. So that's pretty remarkable, and if there's alien life, intelligent life on a planet not too far away, and they're building the kind of telescopes that we hope to build, then they'd see oxygen. They may know that it shouldn't be there, but they may not know 100% that it's caused by life. So absent oxygen, actually, and Earth oxygen wasn't present for, you know, half of Earth's existence, what else could there be? Well, on Earth, we have one set of gases, like methane and nitrous oxide, that are very abundant. But these gases actually are just full with false positive. There's many, many ways to actually make these gases, because geophysics just has the same gases. Geophysics and geochemistry have the same gases to work with that life does. Then there's a whole other set of gases, methyl chloride, dimethyl sulfide, and a long, long list, actually, that are produced by life maybe uniquely, but they're produced in such tiny quantities. It's like when you walk through a pine forest and smell all the smells coming off the trees. Those are biosignature gases. And actually, they're in such small quantities, we don't really know which ones might accumulate in a planet atmosphere different from ours. And so this would be our equivalent of a crisis right now, because we know that the next generation of telescopes are coming up. We know rocky planets are out there. We know we're going to find them around the nearest stars. But how do we actually proceed with this case of false positives? And so actually, I started on this problem, and I had my own theory here. And I just want to know how many of you get emails like every day with from people who have their own new crazy theory in physics. I'm pretty sure it's everybody here, right? So actually, I get those emails too, actually. But then I had my own theory, but who do I go to? Because my theory was in chemistry, right? I thought that life must produce every small molecule I could think of, but actually I didn't know that much chemistry, so it was easy, right? Think about it. Carbon dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, anything. So I actually had two biochemistry friends, colleagues that I worked with for a couple of years on this project, and I emailed to a Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine, actually, he's in astrobiology. So I went to see him, and he actually killed the theory like on the spot because he came up with a counterexample. But nonetheless, we still worked on this theory, and just as an aside, it's not relevant here, but we think we found something really interesting related to the classes of molecules that life doesn't produce at all. But nonetheless, we went through this work and went through all these small molecules. I actually did. I wrote this like big combinatorics code, and the goal is to actually figure out which molecules are stable and volatile in a planet atmosphere that could be like Earth's. And then our goal is to pump it through our atmosphere models that involve photochemistry and a whole bunch of other things to see which molecules could accumulate in which environment. And we're just so driven here to find the list of molecules that should be outstanding, that we should search for, that don't belong in the atmosphere, that are there in huge quantities but can't be explained in another way. And that will be some suggestive evidence that there may be life on another planet. So that's the funnel diagram to summarize that point, that we want to imagine all small molecules that are stable and volatile and funnel them through some big thing that we're still working on what that is and pop out at the other end a list of molecules that we should all be ready to see. But I just want to address one more thing here, and I'm just showing you some example of spectra. The point is actually about these hydrogen-rich planets. I just want to tell you about that so you can keep it with you and mull it over. You'll probably forget about it until we actually have observations. But these hydrogen-rich planets, when they transit, right, they have the puffy atmospheres. And so we hope that there's life on these planets, and that life produces some biosignature gases. We've shown already with photochemistry and other models of planets that if gases are produced, they actually can survive and accumulate in the atmosphere. So the hydrogen-rich planets are probably our first chance at finding signs of life on another planet. So to summarize this part of my talk, about 20 planets have been found in their star's habitable zone. So the fact that small planets in the habitable zone exist is more or less established. But what we don't know is if those planets have the right surface temperature for life. We don't have any way to know about that right now. We want to be able to see their atmospheres, but this sort of study of exoplanet atmospheres, although it has now started, in the future we have to wait till we can see small planet atmospheres. So now I'm going to get to the last part of my talk. And this is how we're going to go about doing this. And sort of in the interest of time, I won't go into all the details of all the great telescopes out there, but the James Webb Telescope is the one we're going to do to study transiting planets. To find those planets, we actually have an MIT-led NASA mission called TESS. I show you a little picture of it over there. It's got four glorified telephoto lenses. Together, they're going to cover a 90 square degree patch on the sky. Let me say again, 24 by 90 degree patch on the sky, and they're going to tile the sky, doing the whole northern hemisphere in 1 year, the whole southern hemisphere in the next year. And that builds on a bunch of precision photometry space telescopes. We also have the large ground-based telescopes of the future. Let's just say that no matter which telescope we have, people will use it to try to find and study the small planets. But now, for the last part of my talk, I'm going to get to my favorite way to find planets. And this is the so-called direct imaging method. We actually have a problem with Earth, that our own Earth, compared to our Sun, is 10 billion times fainter in reflected light. Our Earth is 10 billion times fainter than the Sun. Now, until I came here and listened to all the talks, I was worried that's such a tiny number. We have to measure something to 10 decimal places. And then I came here and heard the talks yesterday about how people are measuring to 17 decimal places and more. And I mean, maybe you have an advantage because you can control things in the vacuum. But actually, our problem is only one part in 10 billion now. And so that's an issue. And here it's showing you like an illustration of what we'd like to do is put a giant screen in space and block out the starlight so that the distant telescope can observe the planets directly. Now, with diffracted light, you all know that you can't just put up a big circular screen in space, because if you block the light, you will get this airy ring pattern. Okay, and if we could have a point source star and block the light out with a big circular screen, what actually would happen was this first airy ring is actually 100,000 times brighter than the Earth-like planet we would be looking for. So that's not going to work. So instead, over the last, let's say, two decades, and more actually, people have come up with very special shapes to block the light. In this case, this particular shape, this kind of star shape, would give a pattern like this, where you use the light to interfere with itself so that all of the bright parts end up pushed out to the edges of the image. And if you do this right, you could actually get the image, this dark part of the image, to be one part in 10 billion darker than these edges. And that's the whole search for Earth, the whole search for another Earth. It's probably going to have to wait till this time when we can do direct imaging. And it's done on the ground now, and it reaches about a planet-star contrast of about one part in 100,000. So actually, if you want to know more, you can just Google NASA probe class study. There's a version where you put this special shape inside the telescope and block the light out. We call it the internal occulter or the internal coronagraph. We have the one where we put in the outside. We call it the star shade. And actually, I led this study. I worked with, we had a team of engineers at JPL. We worked for 18 months. And this is actually what we hope is really going to happen. We're going to do everything we can to actually try to get the starshade to be launched in the, let's say, next decade. And in fact, any star telescope could be made starshade ready if it has the right, all it needs actually is a communication system so it can communicate with the starshade, and it needs the right type of science camera. And our plan actually is to try to get the starshade to happen. This is the starshade team plan, not the NASA plan yet, to get it to fly with the WFIRST telescope that's going to launch in 2024. So for the last part of my talk, I'm going to talk about the starshade. And here you're going to see an animation of the starshade launching together with a telescope. The petals would unfurl from a stowed position. And then the central truss would expand with the petals snapping into place. Now, to block out the light, these petals have to be made to, let's say, 100 microns, and they have to deploy to within millimeters of each other. But the really hard part of this mission would be that the starshade itself, being about tens of meters in diameter, would have to fly tens of thousands of kilometers from the telescope in order for the diffraction shadow to work out well enough to be able to find the planets. So that's the animation of the starshade. And you're pretty much one of the first audiences that I've told this to who didn't seem completely skeptical about it. okay, you are. So that's why I always want to show the actual real hardware under development in the next one, which is a video. And here it's real time showing you the first stage of the petal unfurlment. And in this particular case, there's four petals only because that's all they could afford, and they're really testing the interface. You can see here the four petals unfurling. And now it's actually going to switch in a moment to a time-lapse video of the second stage of deployment. And here, I always get asked, why are there people in this video? But they're there, actually, in this particular stage, it's not to show automatic deployment, but just to show that every single time those petals are deployed, that they can meet the tolerance of their positioning relative to each other. And there's actually later generations that now, of this test bed that now exists. But one thing I want you to know is that this truss here on the inside, I'm guessing most people won't recognize it, but actually this very one was left over from developing large radio deployables in space. And so this version of the starshade actually has heritage from large radio deployables that are about 15 meters in diameter. They're big elliptical structures in space. And just one more thing I wanted to say. Here's myself and two of the team members. And you can see this petal, right? This particular one was made as a prototype to demonstrate that it could be manufactured. The shape of the petal could be made to hundreds of microns. And so actually, two things are going on with the starshade now. One is to show that it can be manufactured to the required tolerances. And the second one is to prove that the math of diffraction works. And that is actually done in the lab at 0.1% scale. And believe it or not, it's also being done in the desert in North America in the Southwest with 1% scale starshade, actually, about 1 meter in diameter. And it has to be separated at distances of about kilometers And in that case, they don't quite reach the right Fresnel scale, but they're working on making it further away, the telescope and starshade, and with a smaller and smaller starshade. So at the end of the day, when we're done, here's what we're going to do. We're going to find a pale blue dot like Earth. It may not be blue. We're going to look at the gases and look for signs of life. And now I'm going to come to the summary, where I showed you that thousands of exoplanets are known, and that small rocky planets exist. And because Kepler has found so many small planets that we think are all rocky, we actually state with some confidence that rocky planets are common. Habitable planets are anticipated. We found a bunch of planets in the habitable zone of their host stars. It's just a matter of time before we can find more whose atmospheres we can follow up. The next generation telescopes will each have a chance at finding and or identifying a habitable world. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. We have some time for questions.
Hi, yes, you talked about the habitable zone, and I'm curious, is this habitable for human life or habitable for life in general?
Because Great question.
Isn't there some speculation that there may be, you know, methane-based life or silicon-based, you know, chemistry, something like that?
Right now, we're just looking for anything. So we actually are thinking of a habitable zone that any life could live. And actually, it may be not suitable for human life at all in any way. Because if you want to think about where water can be liquid, which forms the basis of our definition for habitable, it actually can be liquid at much higher temperatures than we have at our surface if the pressure is also higher. So we do like to speculate about different life types like silicon-based, but the reality is that at the end of the day, all we can observe are gases in the atmosphere that don't belong. While we're waiting for the next question, I want to add a point that I forgot to mention, and it gets to this whole point. It's really premature to be discussing this for biosignature gases, but it's that whole, I feel like I might be here 10 or 20 years from now, like the last speaker, and be getting grilled, because it's about like falsifiability. You know, if I come here and say, you know, I've got this gas, I won't be coming here and say, look, I'm 100% sure it's a biosignature gas. I'll come here and say, we have evidence here, we have evidence there, and I hope that I can come back here and say collectively, because we found so many planets, and lots of signs of chemistry that's unusual, that we have some confidence that there's life beyond Earth.
Further questions? Yes?
Hello. Thank you for your talk. I think it was very nice. My question is whether, are you thinking also on looking for planets with magnetosphere? Do you have tools to determine whether they have magnetosphere, as that can be also important for life?
The question is, can we ever find a magnetic field? Is a magnetosphere important for life? Because it deflects a lot of high energy particles. And so in exoplanets, there's sort of two camps of thought. One is that we need to know every last thing about the planet and the planetary system. Is there a Jupiter? Is there an asteroid belt that delivered water? And the other thought is, let's just look for signs of water in the planet atmosphere and for signs of life. And unfortunately, we're mostly stuck in that second category, because some things like magnetic fields of exoplanets are incredibly hard to find and very difficult to study. But right now, people are looking for the planets that are very close to the star, looking to see if there's some interaction with the star that could cause a big magnetic field, or planets like our Jupiter is very bright at decametric radiation, much brighter than our sun is. But because of the black body, think of the black body falling off at radio wavelengths, they're both so faint that we can't see it at all. Now let's turn back to Earth for a moment. If we wanted to see Earth's magnetic field, we'd literally need an interferometer in space, actually. From the ground, we can't see the magnetic field of another planet the way that Earth does, because Earth's own ionosphere has a lot of noise. And we think we'd probably need 100 to 1,000, maybe even 10,000 elements of this array, and they'd have to go like far away from Earth to be able to see this. But actually, one of my students happens to be working on this out of her own interest, and the idea is to launch a bunch of small telescopes. They'd be like CubeSats. And they actually don't have to precision formation fly, they just have to know roughly where they are, and it may be part of our future. But on the whole, I'll say we have a lot of things we want to know, but remember the lesson I illustrated for you, that we hit these dead ends and we just have to live with things we won't know.
So regarding the starshade, I had two questions. The first is, if you move towards longer wavelengths, I would imagine you could relax the tolerances on the shape and the construction. I was wondering if that is a useful thing to do. And the related question, I think, is why do you need it to fly so far away? I mean, do you really need to be out of the Fresnel zone?
Okay, there's two questions there. One is, in terms of longer wavelengths, let me think for a second here. Like, the Starshade has lambda over d, has the same problem that we have for, you know, just any telescope. And so with longer wavelengths, we'll also need a bigger Starshade. In terms of tolerances, it's actually, if you make your Starshade big enough, you can relax your tolerances. And so actually, the whole goal here was to think of a mission that could launch together with the telescope or could just be small and lower mass. So there are ways to relax the tolerances. But I think the general statement applies that just to reach one part in 10 billion, things have to be pretty tight overall. The second one is, do you have to be really far away? I mean, we think the answer is yes, and if you work out the math for diffraction, you have to be quite far away, actually. There's not a whole lot of room. Because you imagine, like, why can't I have, like, just a Starshade and have a tiny one and put it, like, right in front of my telescope? And the shadow just doesn't work out properly in that regard. Wait, before we get that, I just wanted to finish answering that question. It's true that you could have that longer wavelength for the Starshade, but I forgot to mention that one of the goals is we don't just want one narrow wavelength. We'd like a range of wavelengths because we want to be able to get a spectrum. And so, you know, you can design the Starshade so it works for a range of wavelengths, and maybe the errors are a little less for the longer wavelength, but they're still tight overall.
What about our own neighbor, Mars? There are evidences for ice and so on. Are there any evidence for these molecules that
yes.
you are looking for?
Mars is a great example, because many of you have heard and followed the saga of methane on Mars. Let's remember what I said. Methane was one of the biosignature gases here on Earth. A lot of life produces methane, but it's also produced by a geophysical process. Specifically, it's called serpentinization. There was one jargon word you may not have heard, but hot water from in the Earth's crust in the oceans flows over rocks and it releases hydrogen. And methane actually gets formed from the hydrogen and the carbon dioxide that has come down from the atmosphere. And so it's amazing because Mars is such a great example. It had methane detected in three different ways, including from the Keck telescope, but it was one of those 2.9 sigma results. Like, nobody really believed it, but maybe they did. The Mars orbiter saw it. And finally, there's the Curiosity rover that landed on Mars. And at first, it found nothing, no methane. And then later on, it found methane. And so there's a time variable methane from Mars. So it has all those elements of it could be a biosignature, it could not be. It wasn't detected, it was. And so it sort of really parallels what might happen in exoplanets in the future. Now, as far as life or no life on Mars, right now, you know, it might be by geophysics. I guess there's some chance it could be by life. Nobody knows yet. We can't say anything for sure right now. But I also like Mars, and perhaps it's a good way to end. And that sort of theme that we've seen over and over again, it's like, what comes after LHC? You know, how long do you keep looking? How big do you keep building? And I feel like with Mars, we'll always return to Mars and keep looking, even if we don't find an answer. Thank you.